This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Eleanor Holmes Norton, is the subject of the new biography, Fire in My Soul, about her life in the Civil Rights Movement and Congress. The author, Joan Steinau Lester, says she wanted to find out how Norton escaped the limitations typically imposed on women to become a national figure. Norton is the congressional representative from Washington, D.C., the place where her great-grandfather settled after he escaped from slavery in Virginia. She was brought up in the middle class while Washington was still segregated. When she attended Antioch College, she headed its chapter of the NAACP. In 1970, after working as a civil rights lawyer for the ACLU, she became New York City's first woman to serve as the Commissioner of Human Rights. Under President Carter, she was the first woman to chair the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, where she was instrumental in writing the sexual harassment guidelines. She served in Congress since 1990. We talk first about growing up in segregated Washington, D.C. In the biography of you, you say middle-class parents in Washington, D.C., when you were growing up, went to great pains to indoctrinate their black children to mitigate the effects of segregation. Can you talk about the type of race consciousness you were brought up with as a child?
Yeah, I was brought up to believe that the white people in the district, many of them had really come from Maryland and Virginia. Some of them had come from rural places. Were not very sophisticated people. And that people who regarded us as inferior, we who had Howard University where many of our parents had gone to school, we who had educated people in our community, we who had Dunbar High School, the college preparatory high school that sent so many people away to college. It is we who should understand that these folks, many of them less educated than we, were to be pitied. And certainly their notion that we were inferior was to make up for the fact that they lacked much of what we had struggled to get. Now, and I do put an emphasis on struggle.
You graduated from Dunbar High School at the top of your class, and this was a special college preparatory school. You were in the less segregated class to graduate. When you went to Antioch, as a freshman at Antioch, you were exposed for the first time to the idea of the Holocaust. You hadn't heard about that before, and you say in the biography of you that it drove home to you how sequestered your segregated world and your education had been. And I'm wondering if there were other examples like that where, as excellent as your education was, there were certain things you realized you didn't know about that you had been isolated from when you entered college.
Well, at Antioch, where I was, my peers were young people who'd gone to Bronx High School of Science and schools like music and art in New York, people who'd come from the very best public schools in the United States, in a real sense put my own education in some context. I knew it was good. It was good for a segregated education. It wasn't as good academically as it should have been, and it certainly hadn't exposed me to the world. The clearest indication of that is that no educated person, certainly from a top-rated high school, should have been able to graduate from high school without knowing about the Holocaust. Understand, this is by this time the Holocaust isn't even that old. We're talking 1955, and yet that had happened to me. And while Dunbar had provided me with a good enough background so that even the gaps in knowledge didn't hold me back particularly, because the grounding had been so good. But the notion that something as consequential as the Holocaust had not ever been mentioned was astounding to me, because the notion of 6 million people being murdered for their ethnicity struck me right in the gut. I understood it immediately because I was a black girl. And I didn't see how any black school or any school anywhere in the United States could have failed to have spent some time, if doing nothing else, making the analogies. Dunbar is where people recruited for the best schools in the United States. It's one of the few black schools that you could come to and recruit people to go to the Ivy League, to the good small schools.
And many of our teachers had PhDs, and yet I did not know that. And it said to me how much else I must not know.
My guest is Eleanor Holmes Norton, and there's a new biography of her called Fire in My Soul. When you started to become associated with the civil rights movement and to live a life that was more politically and socially radical, how did your parents feel about this? Were they afraid that if you moved away from the middle class that you could eventually fall off the edge economically and not be able to get back?
Well, I must say I had wonderfully tolerant parents, a mother and a father. I know when I went to Mississippi, particularly my mother was concerned because this was 1963, before the Delta had, as we said, been opened up to humanity. But I was never discouraged by my parents from my pursuit of these ideas. It may be because my father was a hardcore New Dealer. And remember, he was in the generation that came to the Democratic Party because the prior generations had been Republicans. So he had seen great change in his political life. My mother, also a New Dealer, at times was so disgusted with the racism of the Democratic Party, she voted socialist or even Republican. So these were very intelligent people who themselves had worked their way through college and graduate school. So they never believed that I would somehow go off and be a bohemian and find myself an attic to crawl into.
Now, Joan Steinau Lester, who wrote the biography of you, Fire in My Soul, she says, at Antioch, your justice concerns implied alliance with, rather than differentiation from, the ordinary black person from whom middle-class blacks often tried to escape. Do you agree with that perception? And if you do, can you elaborate on it?
Well, I think she gets that from the fact that I was terribly concerned with economic justice. I looked into socialism. I didn't understand why black people remember, the majority of black people were poor. I made the connection between poor whites and poor blacks. And so I immediately felt an affinity with people who were left out. Who is it? There's Eugene Debs who says, as long as there's a working class, I'm in it, or something. That stirred me. And I early became oriented toward the labor movement, which I saw as the great movement for bringing blacks and whites together who were in the same kind of economic difficulty and in the Congress. And goodness, for most of my life, I've considered myself a Democrat, to be sure, but a labor Democrat. I saw the labor movement turn from one which also excluded blacks, particularly in the craft unions, to unions like the CIO and the UAW, which organized blacks. So yes, I early linked my own racial politics with the politics of the poor and the working class. It just seemed to me to flow together, just as I think my own sense of race makes me see direct analogies to women, to Hispanics, to gays, and anybody else who has faced the kind of discrimination I have faced.
When you were a student, you not only organized in the North, but you spent some time in the Mississippi Delta organizing. What struck you most about how different the civil rights movement looked in Mississippi compared to how it looked up north?
Well, first you've got to recognize when I went to Mississippi. I went to Mississippi in 1963. By that time, SNCC, CORE, the Urban League, the civil rights movement was all over the South, but not in Mississippi. Mississippi was the place where terrorism, and I use the word carefully, took place. For example, when sit-ins occurred in Jackson, the largest city, people didn't just spit on them, they beat them beat them terribly. The sit-ins occurred much later in Jackson. Now, I had met Bob Moses. This was this extraordinarily heroic mathematician, Harvard mathematician, who had gone south, lured into the Delta precisely by the fact that the Delta was where you were not supposed to go and where even the activist civil rights movement hadn't gone. And when Bob Moses came to the North to raise money, I met him, and it is he who recruited me to come to the Delta in the summer of 1963. He wanted me to do a prototype of freedom schools with the notion, perhaps, of having students come in 1964, and we will remember Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, the three who were killed in 1964, to do freedom schools all across the South. We wanted to teach people how to vote so that when they went in, they would know what to say to the man who told them they couldn't vote, how to fill out the forms. And here was I, a Yale Law School student, who could come and do the prototype. And that is what I did. And I have to tell you, different, it was not only different from anything I'd ever seen, it was different from anything the civil rights movement was doing, because of the hostility of the place. Because I came straight, my first day I saw that hostility with people put in jail. And because, in a sense, we had to break open the meanest part of the South. And it was so mean that even a year later, when the hundreds of civil rights workers came, within the first week, three were killed, were murdered. And we still commemorate their lives to this very day.
In the biography of you, you say that after reading Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex, you became a feminist. And you say if you were associated with civil rights, with labor rights, the analogies are intellectually compelling. The transition to feminism is easy. You say what you didn't understand is why the transition didn't happen to everybody who was in the civil rights movement. Why did you feel so strongly that African-American women needed a women's movement?
Well, I didn't feel African-American women needed a women's movement. I believe that women of the world needed a women's movement.
I put it that way because a lot of African-American women, as you say in the biography, felt that the women's movement was so white in its orientation and its population that they didn't identify with it.
That's right. And they didn't identify with it because racial discrimination was so compelling. Race and color had been the birth defect, as someone has called it, of our country, that it was hard to get around it to anything else, especially since racial discrimination was still here when the women's movement rose. That is to say, some of the worst of it was still around. But I thought one way to get people to understand their alliance, even with white women, with women across the globe, was to make sure they understood that half of black people were women, and that black women were not treated equal with black men. That women were valuable allies for black men and black women in breaking through the discrimination, albeit very different often, that blacks faced and black men faced and women faced, but nevertheless of the same genre of irrationality. And I thought the analogies ought to be clear. Once you have experienced discrimination, that it ought to be clear that somebody else, might be a Hispanic, might be a woman who, in fact, was not poor, but who's been excluded just because who she is, that analogy is self-defining, it seemed to me.
You were sworn in as chair of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in June of 1977. As the chairman of the EEOC, you wrote the sexual harassment guidelines. Why did you feel the need to get sexual harassment in writing?
Well, I called the staff in one day. We had seen these individual cases come before the commission. Oh, were they horrific? And what these cases required was a woman to come forward and state sometimes abominable things about what had happened to her. We're not talking rape, but we're talking things that are very ugly. And we saw that employers were aghast. Often they did not know. Of course, the law says you know or should have known when you employ somebody. So the employer was embarrassed. The woman was mortified. I said, just a moment, what are we here for? The purpose of guidelines, which are akin to regulations, is to put all parties on notice of what the offensive conduct is so that they can take action against it. As long as we're sitting here waiting on a case-by-case basis to define even what this new form of discrimination but old workplace practice is, the whole burden is going to be on women. Employers are going to feel victimized because they didn't know, and they didn't know quite what to do about it. And we thought, right, I thought at least, writing guidelines, even though that would be controversial, would at least put employers on notice and they'd begin to chase it out of the workplace themselves. Of course, employers always are against regulations and guidelines. But one of the most gratifying things to see was what happened after the guidelines, because the guidelines asked employers to use the official guidelines of the federal government, our own guidelines, to write their own internal rules. Well, employers were quick to do so, and then to send their rules to us so that we could see what they had done. They also, by the way, were making something of a defense for themselves, at least partially so, if an employee engages in this kind of conduct, although the employer would still be responsible, having taken some action might mitigate some of his damages. So we regarded this as a win-win. Well, and the guidelines withstood Supreme Court review and have been very useful to women and to employers since.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of paradoxical that after writing these sexual harassment guidelines, you went on to see one of your successors at the EEOC, Clarence Thomas, be accused of sexual harassment by Anita Hill after he was nominated to serve as Supreme Court Justice. You were one of the Congress people to say to the Senate, you have to have a hearing on this. You have to hear her. You have to hear Anita Hill and hear her charges. What are your beliefs now about what happened?
Well, I was one of the seven or eight women who walked over to the Senate when it looked like the Senate was not even going to bring this matter up. I thought it would be a taint on the court if, in fact, Thomas went on and this hung over his head. I thought he needed it to come on. There's no question in my mind, if you looked at the demeanor of Anita Hill, think about what it takes to make this accusation, understood her background of honesty and integrity, that what she said was true. The notion that she would sit down and make up some of those was an appalling accusation, particularly since it was brought out of her. It was when the investigators came to her that this was brought out of her. She did not come forward initially on her own with this accusation, but she was brave enough once they came forward and once it had to be made known to the Senate to come forward and state what happened. So there's no question in my mind that it happened. And I think that as time has gone on, anyone who studies that record will understand that this is not a woman who came forward and fabricated such an atrocious notion.
You're a lawyer. Has your view of the Clarence Thomas sexual harassment charges made you more skeptical of the Supreme Court, the current Supreme Court?
It's not the sexual harassment charges that made me more skeptical. We knew exactly where Clarence Thomas stood on issues of importance to black people, to women, to the great progressive laws of the 20th century. I'm very skeptical of a Supreme Court that has done all it could to throw over much of the progress of the last 75 years, but that's not much related to the sexual harassment matter. I mean, he's on the court now. He's got to live with that. I'm far more concerned about the stance he has taken. I think it is a perversion of what it means to have an African-American on the court, to have had Clarence Thomas to follow Thurgood Marshall.
Now, Washington, D.C. doesn't have a vote in Congress. You are the sole representative in Congress. There are no senators. There's one congressperson, and that's you. Could you give us a very brief historical explanation about why the nation's capital doesn't have a vote in Congress?
framers never meant it that way. The district, those who lived in the district for 10 years did have the vote because the district was formed for Maryland and Virginia and took 10 years for it to become the District of Columbia. The framers, I'm sure, expected Congress to therefore give the vote once the city became the nation's capital. Congress never did that. In the beginning, there are many who believe that race had a lot to do with it. It was not a majority black population until almost 1960. But there were always large numbers of blacks here. There's a sense that people didn't believe that this place, which had so many blacks, should have that kind of perhaps shared power. And then there was a sense of a proprietary sense. This is our capital, and we're going to disenfranchise the people who live in our capital. Here you have a city of 600,000 people, and they are second per capita in federal income taxes. They have no senators.
Can you explain to us where you have the vote and where you don't have the vote, and how, if at all, that's the status of that has changed during your years in Congress?
I don't have the final vote on the House floor, which is the vote that's emblematic of American citizenship. That's atrocious since my people are second per capita in federal income taxes. I do have the vote where many people think it counts most, in committees, because that's where you bring home things to your constituents. And I actually won the right to vote on the House floor in the Committee of the Whole, as it is called. I'm a constitutional lawyer. Shortly after I got to Congress, I figured out that if I could vote in committee, that I could vote in the Committee of the Whole. That's what you see on C-SPAN. And that's where most of our business is transacted. Then there's a final vote there, but most of our business is transacted. And I got the right to vote in the Committee of the Whole. The Democrats were in power then. The Republicans sued. The courts upheld the right to vote in the Committee of the Whole, but the Republicans, when they took control of the Congress, then took back that right to vote. And this is
that was in 1995.
That was in 1995.
So what you want now, you're going after the full vote.
Now I'm going after the full vote in the House and the two senators that anybody who pays federal income tax in this country should be entitled to.
You are now in a Republican-controlled Congress and at the same time as a Republican president. So the Republican Party has a lot of legislation that it's going to try to push through during this Republican era. What do you think will be the Democratic strategy to try to prevent that from happening?
With Republicans in control of both houses, the Democrats are going to have to do two things. One, appeal to the public to bring pressure on the Republicans so that we can force compromises. And two, depend largely on the Senate, where a senator, even in the minority, can keep things from happening. I should indicate that in many respects I'm unlike most members of the House because my city's budget, after it passes, it has to come to the House because the Congress can still intervene in our business in the most undemocratic way, and because there are no senators. I have had to learn to work with Republicans who are my ideological opposites, and that has been perhaps some of the fun of the job. A close ally, and people will not believe this, was Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich, like me, was a professor. I had been a tenured professor of law at Georgetown. He was a PhD. He had a great appreciation for what the nation's capital was and should be as a historical matter. And time and again, he was very helpful to me. I work closely. I have an understanding with our speaker. I've even worked with Trent Lott on tax matters for the District of Columbia very cooperatively. Never saw any of the racism that so appalled people, or if it wasn't racism, certainly the racial insensitivity that came out. So in a real sense, I'm put in the position where, despite being a deeply ideological Democrat, when it comes to national issues, when it comes to issues affecting my city, I've got to make Republicans understand their obligation to work with my city. I work with this president, I work with George Bush, his father, and I've been able to do this because no one expects me to leave my national principles somehow in order to do something for the nation's capital. And I've been able to get lots of legislation that's important for us. I'll just name one. Through a Republican Congress, I got a bill that allows any youngster in the District of Columbia to go to any public college anywhere in the United States at low in-state tuition, with the federal government paying the difference. And I argued that we had only an open admission university, wonderful one, but it certainly doesn't fit a district of 600,000 people, and that if we valued education, district residents had to have opportunities for higher education similar to people who live in states, and we won that. In order to do that, I had to work with Republicans in the Senate, Republicans in the House from the committee level on up. So in a real sense, my career, I think, shows that you can have a schizophrenic career in the House of Representatives.
You know, the biography of you quotes how you introduced Newt Gingrich to the people gathered at a town meeting in Washington, D.C., and this is when he was Speaker of the House. I'll read this. You said, in introducing him, you said, "I want you to know that the Speaker has helped me in many ways. When it looked like the district was about to lose $200 million for these raggedy roads out here, I went to the Speaker and was able to save that money. But the Speaker knows I oppose his entire national agenda, from the Contract on America to the death penalty, and he knows that I seek to replace him as Speaker of the House of Representatives. I'm very pleased to introduce you to my good friend, the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich." That's schizophrenic.
Well, Newt loved it. He fell out laughing. So did I. Because that was our understanding all along. You may remember that it was when Newt was Speaker that the federal government kept closing down. Well, the District of Columbia, which had its budget over here, even though it had already been passed because it had to be somehow ratified by the federal government, therefore closed down with it. If you can imagine, this is a living, breathing city, and yet we got closed down with the federal government. The federal government got closed down at least five or six times thereafter. Each time I went to the Speaker and said, "Newt, you're not going to close down this city, are you?" And each time he kept it open. So I'm not one of his detractors. Of course, I disagree. I said so. I said so openly. But that didn't keep us from working closely together to benefit the nation's capital. It was his capital, too. It's not just my capital.
Now, you say that you didn't see a racist side of Trent Lott. Although Trent Lott was forced out of his position as majority leader, he's going to get a prestigious chairmanship in the Senate. What's your reaction to that?
I think the difficulty the Black Caucus had with Trent Lott was largely that he was the leader in the Senate. We don't have anything to do with how they apportion their chairmanships. I think probably most people thought he would get a chairmanship. We think that whether or not he remained in the Senate wasn't our business either. That's the business of the people of Mississippi. Only they can decide that question.
When he said what he did at Strom Thurmond's birthday party, did you see those comments as reflecting a racism that he still had? Did you see those comments as reflecting racism that exists in other parts of the Republican Party?
Well, I'm very reluctant to attribute racism, which is seen as a kind of personal attribute, to anybody. Here I bring from the civil rights movement the sense that we didn't particularly care where people stood on us. We just cared how they treated us. Now, I have to be clear. Trent Lott had been very helpful to the District of Columbia. In no way had I seen any racism or even the kind of racial insensitivity, as some would call that remark. And yet, it is clear that Trent Lott had once represented a district in the Congress. Remember, he came from the House, where you could speak loosely about race, and that stuff, that old school stuff, was still with him. He hadn't shaken it. Look, the Senate is full of reconstructed men, people who lived lives with racism and who have changed. I think people who have changed need to be rewarded, or else they don't have any reason to change, because no matter what they do, you're not going to be with them. I remember when George Wallace ran again. I mean, he was out, and then he came back and ran for, I guess, governor. And Black people actually voted with him. At that time, I was a young woman. I couldn't believe it. I said, how can they vote for George Wallace? But African Americans had seen a real change in George Wallace and rewarded him for changing. I'm talking about the African Americans in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So in a real sense, the notion that once you had those views, you are persona non grata with us is very self-defeating. Our point should be to bring them to us regardless of how they feel, regardless of their views. We want to make sure they vote with us and that all the outward manifestations of racism are gone from everything they do.
Eleanor Holmes Norton is my guest, and she's the congressional representative from Washington, D.C., former head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, former ACLU lawyer. There's a new biography of her called Fire in My Soul. The Republican Party has been trying to expand the number of African Americans in the party and to expand the number of very visible African Americans in the party. Opinions of those efforts?
Oh, they are pathetic. For example, the Republicans have a party problem. They like to say that somehow Democrats take blacks for granted. Be real. Did we take them for granted when the Democrats actually lost the entire South, the entire white South, because it embraced racial harmony and racial equality? I mean, it is Democrats who stand up constantly for the agenda of black America. The Republicans, interestingly, these days come forward with their own black agenda. They say, well, we have things that blacks are for, and they come up with something like faith-based, you know, whose primary beneficiaries will be the religious right. And I don't know of a single African-American leader who has put faith-based at the top of his list or even hardly on his list. Indeed, the president's faith-based initiative, the entire black caucus opposes because it allows religious organizations to discriminate in who they hire, hiring people only of their own religion. Or they put vouchers because many African Americans, in their concern with poor public schools, if asked, will say, yeah, I'm for a voucher, give me some money to go someplace, I'll go. Once their own representatives tell them what that voucher would mean and where the money would come from, you will not find our constituents, our black constituents, voting us out because the black caucus 100% opposes vouchers. So vouchers and faith-based is on their agenda. Look, fellas, is all I can say to Republicans, none of that is on the African-American agenda. You go into the ghettos, that is not on their agenda. They want uninsured to have health care. They want the Republicans to put affordable housing back on the agenda. They want the president's education bill fully funded. They want Republicans to stop shooting affirmative action in the back. I don't see any of that on their agenda. Until it's on their agenda, at least in some form, they are not going to get African-American votes, pure and simple.
You helped write the affirmative action guidelines. What do you think would be appropriate affirmative action for today?
Unfortunately, many Americans, including many African Americans, don't understand that affirmative action is a temporary remedy. You don't have nearly as much need for some kinds of affirmative action in some places, for example, some workplaces, as you would have had when I chaired the Equal Opportunity Commission beginning in the late 70s. What you certainly need today is the kind of affirmative action now being fought over in the Supreme Court in the University of Michigan cases. Last thing you want to do is to cut the legs out from African Americans who are striving to get the best education they can. This is an example of where African Americans will be watching the Republican president. Will he go in and ask that this program, which is so critical in a state university, be taken down? If he does, I mean, I think that's just the ball game.
I want to tell you what I thought was the funniest part of the biography of you. One of the first times, well, one of the early times you were on TV in your position as a commissioner of human rights in New York, You used the word Polak to describe Polish
people.
Oh,
I'm glad you think that was funny. I was humiliated.
Well, you didn't realize, apparently, that this was a slang derogatory expression for Polish people. What impact did that have on you to use something that's a derogatory expression and not even know that it was that?
That's akin to not knowing that 6 million Jews had been murdered. I grew up in a very black environment. No exposure to white people. Certainly no exposure to ethnic white people. The only white people that were here, you know, were white people from Maryland, Virginia, or native Washingtonians, sometimes hillbillies, but people with Polish names or even Irish names and Italian names. They didn't live, for the most part, in D.C. And I don't remember ever having to refer to Poles. But here am I, sophisticated Yale graduate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, had been an ACLU lawyer. I have my own television program once I became human rights commissioner. And I use the word Polak just, you know, blacks, not even understanding what I'm saying. That is no excuse. I couldn't believe it when I came off the air. And people said, you know, you use the word Polak. I said, yeah, let's see. It would be better to say Pole. Then, of course, I recognized that the fact that this was stupid and ignorant was no excuse. There's no excuse for being stupid and ignorant. I should have been exposed. I should have somehow picked it up. And so the way I dealt with it was, and perhaps Trent Lott should have done this, to be immediately apologetic, to say, this was an inexcusable thing to do. I told them why I did it. I didn't want people to think I did it because I really believed that that was a term to be used, and I kind of wiped it from my view, and it kind of just came back. I told them I was stupid and ignorant, but stupidity and ignorance is no excuse, particularly when you're a Human Rights Commissioner of New York. I have to tell you that Poles in New York were wonderful. After they heard me, and, you know, the Daily News had my picture with my big afro and had quoted what I said and then quoted my response. After they heard my response, I got so many letters and so many calls, really of forgiveness, of understanding from Poles in New York. So I appreciated the way people received my stupidity.
One last question. Anyone who looks at the biography of you, Fire in My Soul, will see photographs of you with a very, very large afro. when you had your afro, when you first started to grow it, what was the importance of it to you?
I long for my afro. Now I have to keep it short. I still have an afro. It was one of the first blacks I knew to get an afro. And I have to say it came after Black is Beautiful became a slogan. I had always detested having my hair straightened. Boy, I had hated that. And then the edges got nappy. You'd have to touch up the edges. And when Black is Beautiful revealed, and I must tell you, it was a revelation that this nappy hair wasn't ugly. It was the way it was supposed to be. There were ways to wear it that were attractive by letting it all hang out and grow. You know, there are many ways in which I have felt liberated. One was, of course, when feminism came and I could be truly liberated to be the woman that I think I was always becoming. But nothing is more liberating than letting your hair be naturally what your hair is so that you don't spend all your time thinking about your hair. And you regard your hair as perfectly acceptable even though it's natural, indeed as beautiful even though it's nappy.
Eleanor Holmes Norton, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Eleanor Holmes Norton is the congressional representative from Washington, D.C. The new biography of her is called Fire in My Soul.